I want to welcome you to this session. My name is John Siegenthaler, and I am chairman of the Freedom Forum First Amendment Center, which is located at Vanderbilt University. And for 45 years, I was a journalist, a reporter, an editor, a publisher, an editorialist. I want to begin by advising the members of this panel that I spent part of the day in this room observing and analyzing the audience. And during the question period just before lunch, I heard somebody ask an official of the United States government how he would define the difference between a terrorist and a freedom fighter. And I should say for the members of the panel that after looking closely at the audience, I can assure you that both terrorists and freedom fighters are here. And by the time we're finished, I'm certain that the panelists will understand what I mean. I want to thank my colleagues at the Freedom Forum and at the First Amendment Center, three of them here, R.B. Quinn, our legal director, and Ned Ramage and Tiffany Villager. Ned, who handles our technology, Tiffany, who is our chief researcher and a lawyer, for arranging for us to bring this panel to the tension-filled place called cyberspace. And I'd like to take just a moment to introduce my colleagues on the panel. To my immediate right is Donna L. Hoffman, who's Associate Professor of Management at the Owen Graduate School of Management at Vanderbilt, where she and her colleague, Professor Tom Novak, are co-directors of Project 2000, which was begun a couple of years ago to study marketing implications and commercialization questions in a computer-mediated environment like the World Wide Web. She, as most of you know, is widely quoted. She's an authority on internet marketing. Her recent scholarly study analyzed most carefully and most accurately, I think, the numbers of people who now have access and what that access represents. She has contributed widely to books and articles. You read her both in Wired and Hotwired, and it's great to have her here. I don't see enough of her in Nashville, so it's great to have her at my side here today. Next, I'd like to introduce another person who's familiar to many of you in the room, Mike Godwin, staff counsel for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, where he has advised users of the electronic networks about their legal rights and responsibilities, where he has instructed criminal lawyers, law enforcement personnel about computer civil liberties issues. He conducts seminars about civil liberties in electronic communications. He is well known to those of us who are interested and concerned about First Amendment values and what their future is in the new world of new technology. And I'm glad also to see him again and to be on a panel with him. Next is Sander Van Oker. Sander Van Oker is a professional journalist. At present, he is a professional in residence at the Freedom Forum, where he's working on a three-part video series on the post-war Congress and the media. Earlier, he did a three-part study on the press, the presidency, and the television age. 40,000 copies of that video cassette, that three-part series, are now in college and high school classrooms across the country. I think many of you will recognize Sander Van Oker as someone who has been over three decades an expert in the field of political reporting as a journalist. He has participated in presidential debates from 1960, the Kennedy-Nixon debate, until the last one, through the last one. His face has been recognized on all of our networks over the years of a really distinguished career. We were lucky to have him as a fellow, as a scholar at our center at Vanderbilt for a year's work. And again, it's good to see an old friend. Next, John Schwartz. John Schwartz, I hope most of you know, is the author of what I think is the premier newspaper column that deals with issues and questions on the internet. He is a science writer for the Washington Post. He lives in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Last time we were together, we were on a panel at the University of Texas, he's known because I think he is not only ahead of the curve on issues involving the new technology, but also ahead of the competition. And finally, Bill Kovich, who is a curator of the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard University. Bill Kovich heads the program which brings each year to Harvard the best journalists from across the United States and matches those with an equal number from around the world. He was the editor of the Atlanta Constitution and Journal, and during that period, each year, the journal was recognized as the winner of Pulitzer Prize. He served with great distinction as an editor and journalist for the New York Times, both in Albany and in Washington, D.C. He began his career on the Nashville Tennessean, where he spent 6 years, and he is gray, not because he is old, as old as I am, but only because he worked for me for those 6 difficult years. The subject, we're indebted to Bruce Cobol for really defining for us the parameters of today's discussion, posing questions such as whether the new media can assume the role or compete with or replace the conventional media in providing a primary data flow of news and information to a mass market audience that now gets most of its news and information from television, supplements it largely by reading newspapers and magazines and listening to the radio. Can the new media have a far enough reach to make the effective counterpoint in providing news and information to the traditional media? Beyond that, the question of whether the new media can become the medium of record. Will the new media, if it has the potential to do so, deny or enhance access to all of the people of the country? Will it totally democratize our society, or does it have the potential to divide us into political and economic haves and have-nots? Well, these questions feed many others, which I'm sure occur to you. There is, I think, a sense of tension between the traditional media and the new media. I'm sure that we'll hear some of that during the question and answer period, and given the generational gap represented on this panel, perhaps some of it before we go to questions from the floor. There are two of us, at least, Van Oker and I, who remember when a mouse was something that ate was caught by a cat, when a drive was something the family took on Sunday afternoon, a net was something used to catch fish, a web was a parlor for a spider. Many people of our generation are perfectly happy and satisfied without having any access to the net. Of course, we also know that many in that same generation are turning off the conventional media. We can remember when television was the new medium, when many of the questions being raised about that new medium in our medium, which was the print, many of the questions raised are being echoed today as the tension develops between the new and the old. I want to begin by asking Donna Hoffman just to take a look at the issue of whether it's fair to equate, based on all your knowledge about it, to equate that tension that we feel today, some of which we will undoubtedly here in this room and feel in this room to that advent of television when many people in print were scared out of their wits and fearful that it meant the end of the road and the end of the line.
Well, I think it's very useful to look at the traditional media, particularly when we're trying to study or, and understand new media, like computer-mediated environments like the World Wide Web on the Internet. But I think the more interesting parallel is actually with radio, because their parallels have been drawn with the early days of radio and the early days that we're experiencing right now with the Internet. And some wonder, will the Internet go the way of radio, which is a one-to-many medium, or will it reach its potential as a revolution in democratic many-to-many communication? Now, some people would argue that it's commercial interests and activity that drove radio to evolve from a one-to-one medium in its very early days in the early 20s toward a one-to-many medium and took it off the path that many felt it was going on toward a many-to-many medium. But in fact, I would argue that radio, as an example, simply doesn't scale as a many-to-many communications medium. And it's instructive, I think, to understand the net to see why. It couldn't go many-to-many because it lacks many of the unique features that support the Internet as a many-to-many medium, namely telepresence, the idea or sense of being present in a mediated environment, network navigation, which is self-directed movement through the web or through the Internet, hypermedia, which combines multimedia and hypertext links, and then machine interaction, which is basically the idea that users can also be providers to the medium, which is a critical concept for the Internet. Now, radio scaled as a centralized one-to-many medium because of the nature of the medium, especially the inequality of the costs that were associated with receiving and transmitting information, which were not the same, and also the type of content that was suited to the medium. Now, in contrast, the Internet has already succeeded fabulously as a many-to-many communications environment, and what we have to do now is move the medium forward. In order to move the medium forward is to develop those commercial models that will preserve the unique features of this medium at the same time that it will support critical mass, because it's commercialization that's the engine driving critical mass, and it will only be through critical mass that some of the benefits that we'll talk about today will be realized for everyone in human society.
You know, you say that commercialization is the ultimate question. I think there are many of us who spend our lives in the print, in the newspaper and magazine business, who consider the critical question one of regulation. And you mentioned radio and its period as the new medium. I just like to raise a question. Isn't that really, Mike, where all of the contemporary regulatory problems began? Aren't we living today with the legacy of time when radio was the frightening new medium that was going to promote messages that the government was afraid to hear?
Well, I think that's right. One of the things in which the advent of this new medium is like the advent first of radio and then of television is that because it's new, people are frightened of the power of it. People are particular, especially when you're in a transitional generation. A lot of adults and policymakers, you know, grew up without ever having access to the medium. They don't always see, I think, the First Amendment significance or the applicability of longstanding First Amendment principles to a new medium. In the early days of radio and television, which, by the way, were the early days of the 20th century, 1912, I think, was the first Radio Act. One of the things that's quite clear is that neither Congress nor the courts really recognized there being a very deep First Amendment significance at all to broadcasting. And as a result, it was very easy to put a regulatory framework in place. It was ultimately replaced by the Communications Act in the 30s that limited what people could do with broadcasting in the interest, of course, of the highest social good. Now, one thing that's different, though, is that in the 20th century, in the course of this century, in the United States, we've done a lot to develop and evolve our understanding of First Amendment principles. Most of the case law that we routinely apply in First Amendment cases was developed in this century. It doesn't date from the 19th century or from the era of the framers. It's fairly new in the history of the Republic, but still we're later in the process of understanding the First Amendment than we were at the beginning of the century, which is when radio began, and the middle of the century, which is when
let me pursue that for just a moment with you, because if I heard what the courts were saying, what the Supreme Court has said prior to the FCC era of deregulation of content primarily, the court was saying over and over and over again, scarcity, scarcity, scarcity.
Right.
And scarcity is the reason for regulation. And all I hear now when I hear people, I just heard a congressman say he's going to introduce a law that offered to deregulate or kill regulation on the internet. But every other congressman and senator I've heard about is worried about content in the new technology. There is no scarcity argument to be made here. I mean, is this
right.
going to be just a morality question? And I asked Mike to respond, but all the members of the panel know that this is not going to be down the line. We're going to get into it with each other.
Well, let me try to take the constitutional aspect of that, and that's that there have been two justifications historically for the government's broad prerogative to regulate content in the arena of broadcasting, and one of them is scarcity, the at least purported scarcity of broadcasting frequencies as a resource. Now, that's been heavily criticized by the commentators, but, you know, the Supreme Court renewed its commitment to that justification as recently as 1994 in the Turner Broadcasting case. The second rationale, which may or may not be dependent on the first one, is the notion that there's something, as the court has said more than once, unique or uniquely pervasive about broadcasting. There's something about that medium that makes it different from other communications media, and that therefore justifies broader federal or broader in general governmental authority to regulate content that is broader than it can regulate content in the print world. Now, because the only new medium that we've really dealt with in this period, the only thing that's just genuinely brand new in this period has been broadcasting, we haven't really seen what extent, the extent to which the courts will take that kind of different rules for different media approach and apply it to things like network communications. And I think what we see now, both legislatively and the courts, is kind of a war. It's sort of a war between the people who would like to say that the First Amendment principles for the print media are the default setting. That's where you begin with. That's the presumption. And that the First Amendment rules for broadcasting, well, whether you agree with them or not, they apply to broadcasting, and they shouldn't apply them to other media. And then there are other people who say, and there's some support for this position, that every medium ought to have its own rules. Or in general, there's some kind of general federal or general governmental right in the interest of the welfare of children or in the welfare of people in general to regulate content that couldn't be regulated in print. And the obvious example, I think, or one obvious example is Howard Stern, you know, who can clearly be fined for content that is not obscene, not legally obscene, when he says it over the radio, but he can take that content, take transcripts of those very shows, put them in a book, and put them in a bookstore, and not only will he not be finable or liable criminally for putting that there, but the owner of the bookstore will not be sent to prison because of the chance that a child might come across the book on the stand.
Let me ask Senator Van Oker. You spent as much time in television as I did in print. I functioned under the mandate of the First Amendment. You functioned under the mandate of the Federal Communications Commission. Do you think your regulated world was less free than mine?
No.
And I ask it because I think that many people who are into the new technology are worried about what regulation will mean.
It wasn't in those days because so many of us came over from print and radio into this environment of television. And nobody I can remember ever told us what to do. I don't know if that obtains now. But when I came along, no, I just went around about my business and I never thought about somebody telling me I can't do it or not. There was the fairness doctrine. But I think in a professional sense, my generation was very careful to be fair. unlike what exists today on radio. So it was never for a problem for us in those days, no.
John, there is a sense, my guess is that many people in the audience share it. There is a sense that, particularly at the management level of the traditional media, there is a fear, there is trembling and trepidation about what this new technology is going to do to newspapers, what it might do to television. You find that inside the Washington Post?
I certainly hear the argument a great deal outside of the Washington Post. It's the sort of thing you can find on any day's visit to alternate media coverage or any of the places where the media is discussed online. I also get a pretty healthy dose of it in email. I generally respond to the people that say that there is a conspiracy to somehow silence or drive people away from the Internet, that, with all due respect, they've been thinking too much, that the news organizations aren't smart enough to really command a good conspiracy. In any given week, in my newspaper, The Washington Post, you will probably find a half dozen to two dozen articles that have something to do with the Internet. In that time, some of them will be absolute puff pieces about some wonderful thing, some heartwarming event that's happened online and how people have come together to love, grow, share. and then almost as certainly, there's going to be something that talks about an issue that raises deep questions about the problems with the vast unregulated Internet in the same newspaper. I think the problem is that my newspaper, like most that I've come across, has somehow become a journal of many voices without much adult supervision.
John, don't you think there's like maybe a symbiotic relationship, at least sometimes, between traditional media and the Internet and communications online?
Well, absolutely. In fact, not only is the conspiracy theory not right, the newspapers are doing everything they can to be there, to try to work their way online, some doing a more successful job than others. The New York Times website is awfully spiffy. The Washington Post is still trying to get there. We bought into a proprietary software system. But we're getting much better. and we all have the capacity to grow.
Let me put the question to Kovach and then ask. I mean, I don't particularly want this panel to proceed with me asking a question every time one of you finishes. So let me put this question to Kovach and then ask all of you to engage each other on it. And I'll put it in as provocative a way as I can. As I observe my own business, what was my business, newspapers, and as I observe television, it seems to me that while those of us who were working as journalists felt that content drove everything, when I moved in the front office, I understood as publisher that economics drove everything. And I think that's true today, maybe more than ever before, of television, newspapers, radio. It seems to me that, and maybe I'm wrong about this, maybe I don't know much enough about it, but it seems to me that the unanswered question in terms of the viability of the new media replacing, competing, or taking part of the action away from the conventional media has to do with whether the economics will long-term be viable. How do you respond to that, Bill?
I think that's the fundamental question. I think the question about what's emerging now in the digital future is a question of who's going to organize this new world of communications and how. I disagree a little bit with Donna about the early days of radio. I do think commercial interests were vital in the organization simply because RCA came out of World War I owning the technology. And Albert Lasker figured out how to advertise on a network of radios and pay for it. And it was that concept of how you pay for a network broadcasting system that made the kind of radio we, I believe, came to know and love or hate, and set the model for television when it came in. Government regulation was a different form of a problem. That was a content regulation of a different kind of political content. Commercial forces would organize and regulate political content just as vigorously and just as interestedly as the government ever will, for different reasons. And I think in the world we're moving into now, where all forms of communications are the same, that this merging of forms, video, voice, and print, and the merging of the two forces of regulation, government and commercial, is the world we don't understand yet. And if you watch what's happened so far, the impact of the digital revolution has been felt first in the economic sphere, and it's changed the world of finance, and it's changed the world. And it challenges the whole concept of the nation state. I mean, that's a pretty powerful change. And if that same change is occurring in journalism, as I think it is, that's what concerns me about whether or not the whole concept of democracy can work in the new digital world. How do you create a hearthstone is a cheap word, but it's as good as I can think of, a political hearthstone for 250 million people so you can sort of come together on a consensus that will make a political system work. So I think those are the questions that are all up for grabs now.
You could do this in the 30s and create the hearthstone because Roosevelt understood, one, that the publishers were against him for the most part, and secondly, in the beginning there was the word. And when he spoke the word, we listened. And the hearthstone was our old Crosley or Atwater Kent, which we'd listened to Roosevelt during some very dark times. Plus, we used to listen to comedians on Sunday night and Walter Winchell at 9 o'clock. So the radio in those days was a unifying instrument. And to use the opposite extreme, it was also a unifying instrument in the most awful sense for Adolf Hitler in Germany. But now you have the dilution of the voice, whether it's digital or in your ear, because there are so many ways to deliver messages. And I think on the point that Bill has raised, I think we're in trouble in our democracy, because I think we suffer from a Tower of Babel.
Well, let me ask you.
I know where you're headed, and let me see if I can. take a moderator. I wonder whether the better metaphor is not a civic square as opposed to a hearthstone. And if that is the case, don't we have a civic square with both civil and uncivil dialogue going on? And I'm talking about that civic square that is made up by virtually everybody in this room and others like them all across the country.
I think there's two ways to unite a people. I mean, there's probably more, but I'll name two. One of them is by shared experience, and I think that is what the history of broadcasting showed us, is that when you had a world in which so many people watched I Love Lucy or so many people listened to Amos and Andy, you had a kind of a shared cultural experience that united a diverse nation. But one of the reasons that that experience was shared was that so few people, relatively, so few ordinary citizens had access to the medium to speak. They had access for the purpose of listening, but they didn't have access for the purpose of speaking. Now, if you have shared experience, you do unite people, and it's certainly the case that more people shared I Love Lucy in the 50s than share even Seinfeld today. But the other thing that we can share is a commitment to principle. And I think that the First Amendment was not crafted in an era in which
it required a whole lot of capital to speak or to become part of the nation's public life. It was crafted in an era where publishers and printers and newspapers and writers and pamphleteers were essentially small entities, and potentially anybody, the barriers to entry were relatively low, although still you had to buy a printing press. You didn't have to buy Time Warner to access the public. I think that the principle we have to commit to is one of pluralism. I mean, commit to the I think we have to commit to what Sander calls the Tower of Babel. I think we have to say that that is not impoverishment, that is enrichment. Those are voices that were never heard before.
We certainly have the civic engagement potential with this system. But go back to Donna's point originally, who's going to pay for it? I mean, that's the problem we're dealing with now. That's the problem journalists are dealing with. Newspaper organizations are throwing money after any possible way to get into
right.
this system.
I think one of the dangers right now is that as the web develops as a commercial medium, there is a struggle to try to maintain its many-to-many characteristics in a way that can develop this so-called mass audience. And the problem is you cannot have a mass audience with such a fragmented, heterogeneous group of people out there and still allow for this pluralism and this many-to-many communication and preserve its most unique feature, which is that users can be providers. And so one way it could go is a cable broadcast model where we would in effect restructure the internet, apply the business models that we know work in the broadcast medium, and make it more or less a one-to-many or several channels of one-to-many.
Now, will advertising work? Will advertising work?
Under a model like that, advertising might work, but right
that's
now
the only way that
in a many-to-many environment right now, like advertising expenditures on the web last year were running at about less than $100 million, which is a joke in the context of, you know, trying to make money in this environment.
Even with the restrictions which I fear Congress, almost aping what Lord Macaulay once said, the terrifying spectacle of the British public in one of its periodic fits of morality. I've never seen in my lifetime, I'm 68, so much expression. Never have I seen in my lifetime so much discontent. Now is the winter of our discontent. Richard II. Why? Because I think everybody is babbling. If Whitman were writing today, the poem would not be, I hear America singing, it'd be, I hear America kvetching. And how can you run a democracy if we've got such freedom of expression as we do, and that's what our country is all about, then why are we so discontented in our private lives and in our public lives?
You know, I hear America typing.
Mort almost came over the table the last time he mentioned the Tower of Babel. I don't want to. John, do you want to get in? Or you, Bill?
Let John in. He hadn't had a chance.
No, you go ahead.
I agree with Sandy, but I do believe the reason we hear America kvetching is because the system we had before had marginalized a lot of people that we're now hearing from. I think
it's one of the
things that's happened to this system. The problem is, to my mind, is, Donna, if you're right, if you set that model up.
Well, I don't want to set that model up.
Advertisers are going to support entertainment. They're not going
to
support.
I completely agree. I think that's the reason we have to have debates like this, because we have a communications revolution. We have an opportunity for a democratic communication process, which is unprecedented in the history of human society. And one way to commercialize it is to do the things we've done before that have worked
right.
in traditional media. And the natural reaction is, well, let's just apply what works there over here. And, well, we'll have to retrofit and repurpose a little bit, but we can do it, and basically what we'll end up with is some sort of multi-channel cable situation coming over the computer.
That's like what we understood before, and I have to say that it's true that advertising is, I think advertising is going to be important in terms of generating capital for the further growth and development of the net, but the assumption that advertising is the only way to do that, I think, is questionable, because, you know, we have a, you know, in the telephone system, which is an imperfect analogy, it's not entertainment, except, you know, to the extent that we entertain each other through telephone calls, that has driven it. It's the access to other people. It's giving the voices to other people that finances it. Even now in an era where the monopolies have been broken up, nobody's worried about the need for monopolies in order to keep telephone service alive. We know that basic telephone service in which individuals are empowered to produce their own content, as we now say, we used to say talk,
is it actually generates money. I think that the interesting thing about the information infrastructure that we've already begun to build is that you actually get to you get to test all these models. You get to test the advertising and entertainment model. You get to test the common carrier model. You get to test various versions of many-to-many and one-to-one and one-to-many communication. I mean, the web is the World Wide Web is fundamentally a different modality, if you will, of publication than Usenet news groups are, and everybody knows that.
Now,
one of the things that the Wiesenthal Center did when they were objecting to Holocaust revisionist speech was say, oh, we're more concerned about the web than we are about Usenet news groups, because in the news groups, people answer the revisionist speech, whereas in the web, you can't sort of post your reply to a revisionist web page.
Go ahead, John.
Well, what interests me about this babble is not that you can't make sense
ours
of it.
Ours or theirs?
we'll build out, but on the Internet. The so-called babble on the Internet is not how little sense you can make out of it, but how much, how over time voices emerge. Talk radio isn't like that. On talk radio, you're only allowed to call once a week, and if they figure out you're calling too much, they shut you out. And you never get a name with a voice. The idea, it's just bytes. You never get an idea expressed. On the Internet, instead, it's more like a really long conversation. And in that conversation, what starts as babble, you'll go in and you'll start reading a thread in a newsgroup, or you'll start reading something on the web, or you'll start checking out ideas, and you will sift through, and over time people's voices do emerge. And people who weren't ordained by the Washington Post to give opinions are suddenly the people that you're looking for out there. Brock Meeks is sitting right there. And he made a name for himself through his words on the Internet, and a lot of other people are doing that too. What's amazing to me is something that Michael was heading toward before, that this is the closest thing I've ever seen to the marketplace of ideas. That we had the founders talked about it, but now it's almost effortless, it's global, and you survive or fall on the quality of what you say and how you say it.
Let me ask a question. Bill Kovich raised the dirty word of entertainment a moment ago. If I were to look out over this audience, my guess is that all of people who are sitting out here, in a real sense, find entertainment when they go online. It's not entertainment that people of another generation find, but they enjoy it. And that's why it has a hold on them. As I said earlier, there are people in that older generation who say, thank you very much, but no thanks. I'm very happy with my television. I'm very happy with my morning newspaper. Afternoon newspapers don't survive much anymore. I'm even happy turning on the radio and listening to Rush. Hear America fetch through Rush Limbaugh. But is it unfair to suggest that it will take an entertainment factor to make the new technology economically viable?
Well, why is it unfair? You mean it suggests something sort of intellectually unappealing? Because, I mean, right now if we look on the web, we can see the things that are actually making money are involved. Gambling is becoming very big, particularly on the offshore sites.
There's some regulation down the road.
Well, in Barbados you can do it, so it's okay there. Sports wagering, things of that nature, those sites that have, you know.
Let's take all those. A game you want to go to. For years in Washington, I've gone to the Redskins games, especially during the Nixon years, because we had nothing else to root for. You like to go to a movie so you can have a shared laughter. You like the idea of the proscenium arch in the theater. I remember taking my boys, very young, to watch Ethel Merman in Annie Get Your Gun, and when the curtain went out, their eyes went on stalks. You're talking about shared experiences in the round, as it were, and shared experiences through computers, which is a different kind of shared experience. I'm not saying one is better than the other, but I don't think you'll ever get people to give up one to the exclusion of the other.
You know, on the well, let me, I want to share this because I'm not sure everybody knows about this. On the well, Many of us who are participants on that system shared in the course of the last year, and this is something that's personal that's changed over the last 12 months, the process of an individual participant who is a very prominent person sharing the process of his death. He had been diagnosed with cancer, and he talked about it online. And as his, as he, who's a valued member of that community, as his disease progressed, he shared that too, and people who might have argued with him in other contexts had a chance to say goodbye to him and to share what they felt about him. It was as real and as emotionally powerful, I think, as anything that any community has ever shared. I think that to the extent that people who are offline tend to see the world of computer communication as one of, you know, nerds sitting behind keyboards, you know, typing at each other or playing various kinds of games, you know, or Dungeons and Dragons or whatever, I think they've been misled a little bit by traditional media in terms of the character and the richness of what is available in the online world.
Bill Covey.
I raised the entertainment portion in connection with the merging that's occurring in the industry of communications, because it takes a lot of money to get into this game. And we're creating gigantic organizations like Disney, Cap Cities, ABC TV. And in that conglomerate organization, the powerhouse is the entertainment portion of that company. I mean, Walt Disney is welcome the world over. Hard News is not. And the entertainment attraction for advertising dollars is driving decisions in those corporations that will play out in how they want to organize the internet that they have access to or the communication system that they play in this water with.
Danny?
Well, one of our charges here is, can these new media effectively challenge the traditional media for the hearts and minds of the decision makers and the public? Well, one, there are very few decisions made in America. We, I think, and probably this goes on in other places, but I know it here, I find usually that there are a large body of meetings surrounded on all sides by an occasional decision. And the people who make the decisions, they have minds, but I've seen very few that have hearts. Now, Bill has raised a very important question about Disney running ABC, General Electric running NBC, Mr. Tisch, a real estate dealer, bankrupting CBS. But I have to tell you from my own experience, I was very happy I had a large corporation, RCA, a defense contractor, and a very, very important person at NBC, Robert Kentner, a former columnist, who gave his news department all the support in the world. And when the State Department tried to block a man named Reuben Frank from putting on the tunnel, how people got from East Berlin to West Berlin, the strongest supporters in keeping that up on the air and telling the State Department, Dean Rusk, and Lyndon Johnson, who went to David Sarnoff, head of RCA, to buzz off, was the Gulf Oil Company. Because it's not a simple proposition. We took some terrible hits during the Nixon years. I was on the enemies list. I was very grateful that that Leviathan didn't hit me anymore. So it's not an easy thing to say that the increasing conglomeratization will affect news decisions badly. My guess is it will.
Well, the tobacco industry has done a pretty good job.
Huh?
The tobacco industry did a pretty good job with NBC and CBS.
But who's on the run now?
Well, but that's not because of the news broadcast by ABC and CBS.
No, it's by print.
John, were you about to weigh in?
Not this time.
Well, I write a lot of tobacco stories for the Post, so I just thought I'd let
that one rest.
Well, Mike said a moment ago that that there are moments of pathos and passion.
Well, there is something I'd like to bring up with that.
Go ahead.
On that score, the Mike and I have actually debated this and discussed it before. When recently we had our third child, little boy's 2 months old now, and it's terrific. And online, I got this very similar, warm, loving response from my friend, email flooding in, congratulations, virtual cigar somebody sent me. It was wonderful. On the other hand, my neighbors in Tacoma Park brought over lasagna. And even with an ISDN line, you cannot get that through the wires.
And with T3.
T3, try it. It's not going to work. That is not to say that the online world is bad or that it's terribly lesser experience. I would not trade what I got online for the world, but it is a different kind of experience. It feels different. It's better at some times and worse than others. And each of us uses different media all day long. I think you were starting to say, wake up in the morning, look at something on a dead tree, turn on the TV for a few minutes, go to radio, check out something on the net. All these media are useful, and they're all sorting themselves out, each channel of which. I don't turn on Howard Stern when my kid's in the car. But, you know, I look to it for news, or I look to it for entertainment. Each of these has channels that we turn to during the day.
I didn't mean when I raised the question of entertainment that I didn't understand that there were moments of pathos and passion on the internet. It does seem to me, though, that there are the same sorts of moments. I mean, we remember the last great rock star who died. There was a memorial service on the net and a traffic jam. I mean, you couldn't get on that night without waiting to hear them sing the praises of Jerry. And but you know, you get that same pathos and passion on all of the media that reach out to a mass audience. And my question really was whether the entertainment factor, which I think most of us in traditional media admit we couldn't do without, and it includes both print and electronic conventional media. I don't think they could survive without heavy entertainment factor, and I ask the question, is that same factor, for better or for worse, and from my judgment, most often it's not for the better, is that same factor, and is it inevitable that it's going to infect the new media if it's going to be economically viable?
I'm not terribly worried about it because I don't think it's a zero-sum choice whether you get entertainment versus whatever other kinds of content that you get. I anticipate there will be more and more options for the purest forms of entertainment on the net, and they will not be competitive with other kinds of content for bandwidth. They'll be competitive for your attention. The final limiting bottleneck will be individual attention, and individual citizens will make their own choices about what they want to give their time to. But one thing I've noticed is that in my own participation and a lot of other people's participation online, I'm talking about the consumers now and not the people who are funding the network. I noticed that a lot of people are trading off the time that they spend in online forums, whether they're talking one-to-one or talking with groups of people, against their time that they used to spend watching television. They find that more rewarding, and they find that more enlivening. And it's not that they give up television. I don't think many people, I think even the people who've said they gave up television are not exactly telling the truth. Because they're watching the Oscars, for example. But I think that, entertainment comes in more than one form, and the kind of highly capitalized, highly produced Hollywood product that we've come to recognize as entertainment programming, I think it'll still exist, but it won't be the only choice that we have anymore.
And
let's look down the road. Suppose it becomes economically viable. You have entertainment. You have more or less a potpourri of everything that's interesting and edifying, and what E.B. White once said television would do, create the Chautauqua of the air. But is this going to marginalize, the phrase has been used, many people in our society who cannot afford this technique? And then will cries be raised that we ought to give every family one, and that some children will be deprived if they don't have it, and like a flu shot, you will be given a computer.
John,
I raise this as a question.
The answer is computers are dirt cheap and getting cheaper all the time. I read a terrific book last year. It's called Travels with Lisbeth. It's written by Lars Eigner. He got it. He wrote it on a PC that he retrieved from a dumpster. These things are big pens of the 1990s.
Let me ask the next question. I mean, I used to work for an independent newspaper, and I used to go out and make speeches about the value of independent newspapers as opposed to chain newspapers. I once debated Al Newhart on that subject and said that the United States government paid more for the Louisiana Purchase than he paid for the newspaper in Shreveport. He responded to that by calling me on the 3rd of July saying, surprise, tomorrow's Independence Day and you're going to be sold into chains. But let me just, let's just assume that media conglomerates or other conglomerates see that it is economically viable and move in as they have moved in on the other media. And chain ownership of those information databases becomes part of what they have. They control the news and information and will sell it to you. Access is easy. Radios are cheap, and the technology will become cheap. As you said, Goodwill store, $10.
$200 for some of the PCs I see over.
But is that the only concern? Is there not ultimately the question, once you have access, the cost of getting the information?
I'm not worried about the cost of getting the information. I'm worried about people wanting to get the information.
Exactly.
That's the thing that keeps me up nights. I think that, you know, I know people who have nothing and can afford computers, and I know people who could have anything they want and don't own one. I know people who can read and don't go into libraries also. That worries me, that you have the ability, the wherewithal, but not the interest. And I think we as a society need to do a better job of building people's interest in getting information.
And for many libraries that take statistics on who their users are, it's, and certainly not for all libraries, but for many libraries, it's, you know, the librarians take the job and they are committed to their typically low-paying and low-prestige jobs because they believe that the purpose of libraries in society is to provide access to information for people who, you know, we nowadays call the information poor. In fact, the actual usage of libraries does not fall out demographically the way you would think based on that principle. It's often the most highly educated and the most well-off people who use libraries. I think that there will actually be a division between, you know, what you might call the information haves and have-nots, but it's not primarily an economic division in the long run. I think it is an economic division in the short run,
But
it's primarily a cultural thing, there's also, I think, it's a problem with the crisis of our educational system, where we're not teaching people to value access to information. If you don't do that, it doesn't matter if you give the, if you subsidize people, if you pay them to take computers, they won't use them.
Well, I heard you say that it was a cultural problem, and let me just ask, in a society that has grave problems with literacy, and in a society where those problems are most obvious, and most real among have-nots, what's the danger that the new technology widens the gap?
John, Mike and John have said information. I say knowledge. We are awash with information in this society. And you're awash with information because you've got a 24-hour news cycle. You've got the ability to be almost everywhere almost at once. So if you are almost everywhere almost at once, then everything you cover becomes significant. And if everything is significant, nothing is significant. So information, yes, but knowledge. And knowledge takes, when I use it in its broadest generic sense, an editing sense, as you get in a book. There's a wonderful thing that came out this morning in the Wall Street Journal. And it's John Lipman of the Wall Street Journal. he talks about, as a child, the sensual experience of reading a book. So I'm not trying to be a Luddite about the passage of information, but we don't suffer from the lack of information. We suffer here in this country from being awash and nobody saying what is useful and what is not.
I'm going to put another question to the panel, but while I do, I want to invite those who might have questions to come to the microphone so that when I finish this, we'll be ready to move to the floor and spend some time with you. The question I'd like to ask members of the panel who have feelings about it respond to is whether those of us who have spent careers in the traditional media, particularly the news media, whether those of us who have that background and who have believed that professional training was vital in order to provide people in a democracy information they needed, whether that core of professionals is going to be vital to the new information age. Donna, do you have a sense of that?
Well, from my perspective, I see that question more as that we desperately need some sort of ability, particularly in environments like the web, for reputation. Because at the same time that anybody who is also a user on that environment can also be a provider, there's no mechanism right now to identify the quality of the different voices. And so I think that these mechanisms have to evolve. For example, in my own profession in academia, there are a lot of online journals, and there has to be mechanisms that have to be developed so that these journals would acquire quality, have reputation associated with them, and that we know some there's an as a And it's been said there's some sort of editorial process and there's an editor involved. So I think that just as we have in the physical world, we have to have these issues solved in the electronic world.
Well, let me ask Mike in the same question in a different way. Libel, plagiarism, copyright violations, obscenity, every issue, legal issue that now confronts the traditional news media is now being raised as people are talking about regulating the net.
Do I have 60 seconds for that answer?
Yeah, you do.
I think that a lot of people are under the mistaken impression, and certainly is the case outside of this room, that people are under the impression that existing laws, including both civil and criminal laws, don't apply to the net. I think we're already learning that, in fact, it's not the case that the net is unregulated. The net has always been regulated. But let's take the issue because I want to take the permutation of your original question about professional journalists. You know, one of the reasons that we have had an ethic of professional journalism is that not everybody had access to a daily newspaper. And so that you wanted to make sure that the people, I mean, you wanted to make sure that the immense power of mass media was used responsibly. And I say you meaning not government or governmental policy, but I think as a society we had, you know, a consensus that it's good to have professional journalists. And I think we're always going to have that consensus, but it won't be driven by the fear, you know, of not being able to answer back the actions of irresponsible journalists. I think one of the things that the, you know, Time Magazine cyber porn scandal illustrated was that, first of all, it was possible to answer back a major media organization and correct them. And correct them in a particularly stinging and public way. But it was also the case that other professional journalists, people who are part of large organizations themselves, interacted with the individual investigators and the amateur reporters in uncovering that story and making sure that it was publicized within the news cycle when it mattered. And I think the notion that the media stand in some kind of opposition or competition to each other is in itself kind of a carryover from a different era of mass media where broadcasting was perceived as in competition to the movies or in competition to newspapers. That's not the nature of this medium. We will always have a need for professional journalists, and so it won't be the case that the Tower of Babel drives everybody out. It'll be the case that we'll always look to the New York Times organization or to another organization for the quality of their reporting, even when they're not printed on dead trees. And the exciting thing is that many people will become, because of what Donna says,
because of their ability to build reputations for the quality and accuracy of what they have to say or for their insight, many people will be able to become the New York Times or to become the Washington Post on their own without having the millions of dollars necessary it takes to start an urban daily newspaper. And that, I think, is incredibly exciting.
I have about another dozen questions, but my guess is the questions from the floor will be more interesting, so we'll go there.
Yeah, I guess I did that, what you just said, Mike. My name is Brad Templeton, and I publish both the most widely read free thing on the net and also the most widely read commercial news service on the net. So I guess I have some experience with this. And actually, I was going to talk about a lot about what Mike just talked about. I think that the many-to-many, as attractive as it was to us, particularly in the early days, has broken down not because, oddly enough, of noise, but because of the problem of not being able to handle 50 informed, well-thought-out opinions on the same topic. That if you get together too many people in a discussion area, you simply get too many good stories, too many good opinions that you simply don't have the time for it. And I've found that there is a need and a demand for the professional reporting. What's going to change, particularly as news goes online, is that links will become a part of what happens in journalism. And while most people, most ordinary readers, won't follow the links that go away from a story to the sources and the people involved who issued rebuttals or who contradicted the story or the coverage from other sources, enough people will to make the news accountable. Intel learned that it had to be accountable to its customers in a way that no company ever had to be accountable before. Politicians may have to become accountable to the voters in a way that they didn't have to become accountable before. And news organizations will also become accountable, as in the Time magazine case. But actually, I would still say we're not there yet today, and that I don't know if the ordinary reader of Time magazine is aware, other than a very brief apology that appeared in Time a little while after that, that Time committed some journalistic malfeasance when they did that original story. I'm not sure if we've reached that level yet. But we will reach that level, and as news organizations move that way, they'll still exist, and there'll still be people putting out news, and people will still be charging for news, and there'll be large news organizations. But there'll be a different level of journalistic accountability, which will change the media in a fundamental way that didn't happen before.
Thank you. If I could ask the panel just to briefly address one aspect of what he said, politicians may be more accountable than ever before. It's difficult for me to envision politicians being accountable now.
They are
very accountable right now. Now look, you send them there to do a job. They don't do it, you kick them out. The most famous speech in the history of Anglo-Saxon political lore is Edmund Burke's speech to the electors of Bristol. I owe you not my allegiance, but my industry and my judgment. They threw them out. You send them there to make judgments. You can bombard them all the time. But what worries me in this plebiscitary democracy, especially from talk radio, that the people who are telling them what to do want to be the instigators and the mediators of legitimate conflict in this society. Politicians, political institutions, political parties are our mediators. And they do a pretty good job compared to the rest of the world. So my view is, let them make the judgment, bombard them with as much information as you can, but if they don't do what you say, you can vote them out, but don't say they're not accountable.
Well, why in this country do you constantly reelect the members of the House?
Why do you like their
congressmen.
Why do you run a magazine? Because you've got experience, right?
Well, I mean, the answer is that the last time around they didn't. And we got the contract with America, and if that's accountability, well, let's move on, Bill.
In my country, when people didn't like the Conservative Party, they went from having a majority of the seats in Parliament to having two.
But it's the accountability because the people communicate directly with the political figure and...
I don't know what caused that to happen. It was unusual in Canada and other parliamentary countries, but that never happens here, nothing even close. That big overthrow that you had in 1994 in Congress was still a relatively small percentage of the people.
It's impressive to me that we came in here today and saw a senator from Montana up there on that screen telling all of you that he knows where you are and he knows how to reach you, and I think that's pretty impressive. It maybe makes your point.
But they had to turn him on here.
No, I mean, when it came down to go.
Lamar Alexander tried to
When it came down to go, he had another phone call.
Lamar Alexander tried to use this system to become president of the United States, and he fell flat on his face.
He was trying satellite TV.
No, he was trying. No, no, no. He was trying red plaid TV. That's what does.
Philip Pallenbaker, MIT. For the past 3.5 years, I've been working on the web, and one of the people who thinks it has a hand in developing it. One of the points about the World Wide Web is the worldwide part. And a number of the members of the panel were putting a question saying, is democracy in danger because the web is breaking down the nation state? I'd like to make a comment that if that is the case, I certainly would hope that that was the case, because that was one of the things that personally motivated me and got me interested in the web. You may guess that I'm not American. I'm British.
There are some Americans who are a little bit iffy on the nation state, too.
But the coming from Europe, and a culture where we have ripped apart Europe twice a century at a cost of 100 million lives, looking at a planet where we spend more on weapons of mass destruction than we do on eliminating poverty, is it time that we should move beyond the nation state and look to better forms of government, as the founders of this country did in their day, looking upon the tools that they had then? Is it now time that we do the same in our time?
Well, since I mentioned that,
yeah, Bill,
I didn't raise the nation-state disintegration to mourn it. I was just talking about the impact of digital communications on political organization. I tend to agree with you. I just hope what we don't wind up is Singapore.
And I would have to say, while we extol the virtues and the values those founders you spoke of, admiringly, there are many women and minority blacks in this country who were denied a long time access to the rights they gave them, those founders assured themselves.
My name is Danny Weitzner with the Center for Democracy and Technology. I want to come back to the image of the political hearthstone that one of you raised. It's my probably naive hope that the web, that the net and the web, and whatever else is going to be there can save our political process from television. I know that I watch a whole morning of television on Sunday, and I don't know what anyone thinks, and I don't understand anything more about the issues, and I'm just left sort of irritated, and I'm what you call an inside the Beltway kind of person.
You're a masochist.
Well, I do it at, I don't know. That's a harder question. But I really have a question, I think, for those of you in the so-called traditional media. What do you think the net ought to be learning? I mean, what do you think you've succeeded in doing well for the political process? What do you think has fallen apart? How do we look ahead from here? I guess I'm more interested in those questions than the question of what's going to disintegrate, because I think, like it or not, we're all here in some kind of polity, and we now have the net here. What can it do for us that you might have been able to do well at one point but lost the ability to do?
Bill, you want to respond, and then
yeah.
John?
I think there are 2 points on that. One, I think the traditional media helped focus public attention on important issues, especially television, on the civil rights movement, and invited the whole world in to judge how the South had organized its society, and the world said that's wrong and they had to change. I think the traditional media did that. I think the traditional media has done a fairly good job of monitoring the behavior of governmental institutions of power. I think it's done a lousy job, and what frightens me about the new organization, monitoring the economic institutions of power and how they affect people's lives. And I think that's where the new media, if it does not become part of the same oligopoly of power, can help a truly democratizing society understand itself and have some say in how it's organized.
I'd add that when the traditional media are doing their job right, they do two things that we all need to learn. One is, when we're doing it right, we get our facts right. And if we get our facts right often enough, people come to trust us for that. Secondly, and this is tougher, if we're doing our job right, we get the tone right. We get the idea, we get the scale right. We don't panic at small things, and we don't ignore big things. And I don't think that traditional media consistently does a good job of that, but I'm just saying, when it works, this is the thing that we do best, and this is why people look to traditional media, and I think it's a lesson that people are going to learn as we move along, or be filtered out, be bozo filtered out. World of bozo filters.
Donna, you're smiling. You want to
get an oar in? I'm just thinking about my bozo filter.
Thank you.
That may be me.
I'm Lance Hoffman, George Washington University. I have a question related to the one of the stated questions here. Can these new media effectively challenge the traditional media for the hearts and minds? Somebody on the panel raised it earlier, of the decision makers and the public. What I'm worried about is the potential marginalization of the net. Okay? Basically, some of you know that my graduate students and I recently produced a program which is described on some handouts in the back. Some of you have seen, John had a nice piece on it in the Post a couple days ago, which basically sends mail to every member of Congress. Now this, or can, and this in and of itself is not unique. There are a number of sites on the web that do this. We tend to deliver with it a lot of questions, these kind of questions. So you link, as was stated earlier, we almost force the user to link to asking himself or herself all kinds of questions like, what is representative democracy? Should I send something to the Diet or the Knesset or somebody else at the same time? What am I doing here and all that before I actually send it? We do this despite the fact that only roughly 250 of the 535 federal legislators actually have email addresses. I'm concerned that the first two responses we got, the first phone call I got, was from a security officer for the House of Representatives. Who was concerned, now he was actually very good, he understood all the First Amendment issues and the communication issues, he was
That's
concerned
a pretty good
this.
Security officer.
Well, he was up on it. The first email I got was from a staff person to a congressperson who said, you don't understand representative democracy at all because I didn't get anything from Ohio and what's wrong with this? I'm worried that nobody's going to listen to anything coming in over the net. I wonder whether you think this is going to happen or is there going to be some other way to fix this?
Well, it depends on, Lance, I think it depends on whether you think people don't ever learn. You know, and some people, they believe it in good faith, believe that nobody ever learns anything. And if that's true, then when people try to use the Internet, a new medium, to communicate with their elected representatives, they'll make the same mistakes over and over and over again. But I think that, in fact, what we know about human use of media, whether old or new, is that our ability to use them evolves and improves. We use print more effectively now than we did before. We use TV more effectively now than we did before. We use movies more effectively now than we did before. And I think that both as individuals and as a culture, we become more and more sophisticated in our understanding of how media are properly used. And here we are in the first years of the use of this online medium for talking to our elected representatives. And sure, we're dumb as posts. You know, we're stupid. The question is, are we going to be stupid forever? I hope not. You know, I think, and if we subscribe to the theory of, you know, self-government, I think you can't consistently subscribe to that theory and not believe that we learn from our mistakes.
In the series I'm doing on the post-war media in the Congress, Gerald Ford used to send out newsreels, is a word, to be shown on TV stations, and there was an older man who would open a stack of mail about this. Now, you know, what's interesting about what you raised is the franking privileges, the letters you can't, and one of the most wonderful letters was the one Moynihan used to send to the constituents in New York. My guess is, though I can't be certain, that they're being answered now electronically, but I'm not sure about it.
Can I respond very quickly to that? Anybody who tries to mail bomb Congress is going to have a tough time because we tested this by sending just one message. In essence, it was an announcement, dear member, be advised, you may get some messages, and we have a limit on it, in fact, but you may get some messages. And so I received in my mailbox, you know, 300 and some responses automatically for sending that one message.
Next question.
Sean Dolan. I'm glad to see all these Vanderbilt people up there. I'm a Vanderbilt alumni. Also, now I'm working with libraries, and one of the issues you brought up at the beginning, but I really haven't heard discussed, is this new media as a media of record and working with libraries. The print media is really easy to archive, and at Vanderbilt, you have the Vanderbilt Television News Archives, or at least you used to. I think their funding has been having troubles. But television's never really been good for archival purposes, and this new media is just terrible. I mean, websites make the Soviet encyclopedia look like a reputable source. I mean, so how are we dealing with things that change so frequently as trying to be a media record?
Can I say something very briefly about that? I think that Donna Hoffman's and Tom Novak's website at Vanderbilt actually is the publication of record on two or three public issues, notably the Time cyber porn study, the Nielsen net use study, and general statistics with regard to web and net usage. I mean, people go first to that web page rather than to any given issue of a magazine or any other print publication. And I think that's, for those issues at least, her webpage is the publication of record. And if it can happen once, it can happen again.
I think that just gets back to what it suggests is, first of all, I think the medium is ideally suited to creating a permanent record. And there's an enormous amount of information that you can keep forever and store. And, you know, I can go back and, like, Hotwired now keeps all of their, it says, you know, the permanent address for this article is, you know, a place, and you can link, and forever it will be there, or until the storage runs out, or whichever comes first. But in any event, the idea is somebody has to be responsible, and so it gets back to this idea of who will be the editors, who will be the people trying to establish reputations and say, I put some information up here and you can trust it, and over time you develop an identity. So I think the medium is possible that these things can occur, but people need to take responsibility for doing them.
There's so many. Next question.
My name is Larry Kolodny, and my question relates to my doubts concerning the value of the Internet as an engine for democracy. Mike Godwin's comment about the crisis of the educational system reminded me that both schools as well as newspapers are sources of institutional authority in our society, and they not only report information or provide information to people, but they actually tend to structure reality and create a sense of what the world is actually like outside of our immediate sense, ability to sense it. And it seems to me that with the growing influence of the Internet as a source of information about the world, the traditional sources of institutional authority, such as schools and newspapers, are becoming secondary to the ability to just log in and do a web search and find out what the facts are, and also to receive the opinions of a vast array of individuals, many of whom are anonymous in the sense of you don't know who they really are or are not affiliated with an institution. So I guess my question is, historically, newspapers and schools and so forth have provided a sense of common sense of reality within the society, which allows us to have a democratic conversation because we have some basic principles that we all accept, that we live in a democratic society, the way Congress works, the facts about the world, basically. As a new generation of Americans or people throughout the world grows up with the Internet being a principal source of information, which there's really no coherent sense of what the world is like, and the views of the Nazi Party are given as much prominence as the views of the American Civil Liberty Union. My question is, what kind of ideas, what kind of large-scale social gestalt views of the world are likely to develop out of that, and I wonder whether it's going to be democratic ideas or not.
Wow. I can re-quote the Duke of Wellington on the eve of the Battle of Waterloo, reviewing his motley collection of Allied armies to face Napoleon the next day. And quite depressed, he turned to his aide and said, "They may not frighten the enemy, sir, but by God, they frighten me." This is why I brought up the whole editing function before.
There are some universal things around which I think those interest will begin to organize. I think there already are things like the environment. I mean, there are things that are common to all of us that this new system of communications can help sort of provide a baseline of common understanding and common concern around which political movements and factions can develop. So I think there are potentials out there that are beyond the reach of either educational institutions or news organizations that will begin to provide the framework within which, you know, to build a new kind of whatever kind of a world system is coming from all this. But I think it's the common interests that are going to do that.
Mike, before you respond, there are four more people in line there who are going to have questions, and I'm going to entertain all four of them. You've waited a long time, and I think we owe it to you to stay. I would say that I'd like to have more than four people in the room when we finish, so if all of us could speak with brevity.
Okay.
No, Mike, I did not mean that was done. Take everything so seriously in the Civic Square.
He would have said it before me if he were trying to get you.
I mean, we're at the Hearthstone, Mike.
Larry, one of the things I thought that was helpful about your comment was that you said a principal source of information. I think the other sources are going to still be there. But even if you take maybe the worst case scenario in which the most or the primary or even, you know, for many people the only source of information is the internet, I think we learn how to structure, you know, our sense of ourselves and of society and the social order long before we get online. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, very early, very, very early education. So long as we make commitments both as individuals and a culture to at some point try to inculcate in people the belief in the sort of meta values of pluralism and the meta values of meta values of society, then I think that we can survive the internet, because I agree with Sander that editors are quite valuable. I mean, I've had editors who were quite valuable to me, and I still have editors who are valuable to me. But I also know that in my own experience, I've had to become my own editor, not only in what I write, but also in what I read. And I think teaching people how to do that is part of teaching them how to be citizens. And I think we can teach people to survive the internet.
John.
Well, I think that Michael's right. As we learn, he was saying before, we need to learn how to send stuff better, how to send stuff smarter. We need to receive stuff smarter, too. We've got pretty good filters going inside our heads, but we need to train people to use them. It's not like we're a dumb country. People use a tremendous amount of brain power to sift their options when they buy a car or a computer, when it's something that matters to them. The choices we make in our lives that are important to us, we bring a tremendous intelligence to bear on. And that shifts markets, and we get pretty good products out of it. If we could treat ideas with the same respect and political candidates, and then we would do better.
Next.
Hello, my name is Doctress Utopia, and I'm here because I'm an internet writer on Usenet, and I have a news group, Alt Society and Utopia. And it's been a very interesting experience because I'm seeing like myth-making happen on Usenet. Writers are starting to talk about each other's ideas and work as we're trying to understand what this new media is about. But I also see the old institutions trying to creep up, in particular because I write about feminism and patriarchy and the old power structure. And I've become very hated on the net, on Usenet. I have a whole hate group against me. And I think we're just going to have some kind of real transformation and think about what wisdom is, because we could transform the world with this medium. And I want to do it, because for a long time, a lot of people haven't had a voice of wisdom.
Can I ask you a question? What did that mean?
Okay, I think wisdom is, like, for one thing about the transformation, we have to create not new eco-cities, environmental cities. We have to organize our intellectuals in a different way so that we can have, this can be an educational experience, and not just that, an active place, so we can reorganize everything, the full population.
Who's stopping you? Can you give me an example?
Oh,
I'm an old institution, but I don't creep.
Yeah. Who's stopping me? Well, the University of Massachusetts cut off my account, my research account.
Well, what do you call Billy Bulger?
Well, I think that intellectuals need,
I want to let you finish. And after it's over, I hope you wait in the hall and give Sandra the full answer. Because I know he wants to hear it, and so do I.
Yeah, I mean, we really need transformation, and that means an ecological worldview. And it's that is a revolution. Let's have a true global democracy where we can organize a new utopia.
Thank you.
My name is Larry Joseph, and I'm a dead white European male. And I work in a dead medium, radio, public radio, and dead is
really
quote,
dead.
Right. I do a program called Bridges, a liberal conservative dialogue. Although people have written in and said it ought to be called Islands because there really is no communication. The First Amendment applies to you and your friends, but to no one else. I want to make two quick points. The previous speaker illustrates something that I found is, and I have a Pentium computer and I surf the net and all that stuff, but that the net, the web, is a religion as well as something very actual. And the belief that any one of us could be a Scotty Reston or a Maureen Dowd or a Bob Herbert, whoever, is a myth. There's a conservation of talent, and in any given sphere of human activity, there are only so many people that are good at it, whether it's opera singing or cooking or writing or whatever. That's point one. The other point is that what I'm doing on my program and in other domains is following on the work of Robert Putnam, who's a Harvard professor who wrote a paper called Bowling Alone, and he's looking at something called social capital. And Bowling Alone, the title refers to the fact that bowling is up, but league bowling is down. And what he's trying to bring out is that we no longer have time for community activities like talking to your friends, or being a Cub Scout, or a Cub Master, rather, or making love, or anything like that, that we're all working ourselves to death. And that the question is, does this technology abet that? Does it abet hyper-individualism? Does it abet working 24 hours a day? I mean, faxes and cell phones and the websites and all that. And to me, the one issue that has not, the one word that has not come up in this is loneliness, or any other mapping of that word. In other words, does the web really bring us together when you're on the Usenet or you're on the World Wide Web? Or are we sitting in a room by ourselves talking to someone in Ulaanbaatar about something or other, but not talking to our friends and our wife and our cat and our children? That's, to me, that's the most more important social issue about the web than whether Dr. Goebbels is going to come from a server. Thank you.
Let me respond to both of those questions as briefly as possible so other people can. The first one, Larry, is that it may well be the case that the number of truly excellent journalists and truly excellent writers is finite. I'm not sure I disbelieve that. But unless you take the position that every one of those people has found a voice before now, then you should only applaud the web, which makes sure that the number of people who have that voice, the number of high-quality people who are at the Scotty Reston level who have a voice, get their jobs. You know, and get a chance to actually write. That's what the web means. It means that everybody gets to play at the top of their game, whatever that game is. And you know, there is a phrase. Remember the phrase "mute inglorious Miltons." Unless you think there are no mute inglorious Miltons right now, you think that every person who has something to say has already been able to say it through traditional media. You must applaud the chance of people to play at the top of their game and give new quality voices as well as maybe mediocre voices to the public life. And the second thing, since you made two points, is that I think that if you spend time here talking to people who are participants in online forums, they will disabuse you very, very quickly of the notion that people are lonely, sitting alone in rooms and isolated from each other. Because one of the fundamental problems this culture has faced, the main American culture, in the 20th century has been the movement from a primarily rural culture to a primarily urban one in which people live alienated in boxes in cities.
And yet, now you have a technology that allows people to much more easily become intimate again, to create communities of interest again, and to share the aspects, share the dimensions of their lives again. And the people in, there are people in this room who will put the lie to any claim that this is essentially an alienating or isolating technology.
I think the question is what it does to a community, not to a world, but the community. And along those lines, Putnam's latest paper raises a serious question about that in terms of what the impact of television. As he's tracked this loss of community and civic awareness over time in the United States, he has been able, I think, to discount other factors that we thought caused the problem, like constant movement, that people move from one city to another so they never put down roots. He's, I think, fairly significantly reduced the importance of those factors and focused almost exclusively on television, which has done just what you say, has isolated people in their homes in those crucial hours of the day when they might be engaged in community activity. And does the computer do the same thing?
And there at least it would seem to me is the opportunity for interaction. I mean, the couch potato is there. Mr. Couch Potato is sitting beside Ms. Couch Potato with baby couch potato between them and the couch potato cat at their feet. And nobody says a word, but everybody listens a great deal. Maybe neither sell.
It's a Thurber cartoon. The cat, the man, the husband, I'm disenchanted, you're disenchanted, he's disenchanted.
Yeah.
It was about 50 years ago.
That's right, but they internalized that, and I just suggest that neither sell, the one where the couch is located, nor the one where the keyboard is located, may be ideal, but in this world, aren't we better able to pursue socialization through interaction?
Just a quick point.
You raised the question. I think it's a good one.
Thank you. When I was a kid, we got our first television set in 1948. We sat around, not only my immediate family, but the neighbors came in to watch Milton Berle and whoever else.
Texaco.
Right. Ed Sullivan and so forth. Now, in every middle-class home, there's a television set in everybody's bedroom, and every member of the family is watching a different set or Nintendo or on the web. And I submit that what may have some advantages is also destructive of family and of community. Thank you.
Larry, before you sit down, let me just tell you, I have to tell you that many people know this story, but 3 years ago when I moved from Boston to Washington, the moving van which carried my goods caught on fire, and the result was the destruction of almost all of my household goods. And when I posted about this on the well, a fellow named Elliot Fabric said, why don't you post a list of the books that you lost in your library? And many people may have copies of those books and may be able to help you rebuild your library. And I thought that was a nice gesture, but I didn't think it would necessarily lead to anything. But I did post a list of books when I acquired one, and for every week for 6 months, I received books from people that I had never met face to face.
That's very touching, as is your story about your friend who died and or who was dying on the web, so to speak, and got all kinds of solace and so forth. I think the human spirit will emerge from through any technology, but the question is it a net gain or loss of community?
It's not a question for me.
Okay. Thanks.
Next question.
My name is George Mokray, and I don't want to be Scotty Reston. I don't want to do the New York Times. I just want to publish my own listserv every week, which I have done for the last year on environment and telecommunications. And the thing that I've seen in the debate about environment is the same thing that I'm seeing here right now, which is the Congress, as it's conceived right now, does not believe in a commonwealth, and it believes in the free market. And what I'm hearing here is the same kind of tension between the marketplace and the commons. And when I hear people say, what's the economic viability? Well, right now, the net, the web, is economically viable. It's there, it exists, people pay for it, do goods and services, whatever. But what should not be part of the marketplace? What has to be part of the commons? I think that's what we have to figure out, not only for the green environment out there, but for the wired environment that we're talking about here. And one comment at Harvard Business School a month ago, there was something called the Cyberposium, and a vice president of AOL said, people are online because they're lonely and they're bored. So that's their business model.
What? I didn't hear that. People are online because what?
They're lonely and they're bored. That's what AOL is looking at.
That's why they're on AOL.
Yeah. Last question.
Yeah, my name is Gail Williams, and I just had an experience which kind of replicates a lot of experiences I've had online where I have questions formulated and I get to wait my turn and in essence sort of read through the topic or the thread and go, oh, well, that point was covered. Well, I kind of have another question. So instead of asking questions, since everybody's asked so many so well, I wanted to address the concern about the change from an environment where there is a broadcast Hearthstone and center to culture to one that's more fragmented. And I think that we're all going to find a lot of interesting disappointments, and I think it's going to work out fine. But what we're going to find is people expect, for example, that being in a many-to-many environment means that we will get to have as much time as we being quite large, need with an elected official whose time is by definition very limited. And I just wanted to say that probably a lot of us in this room have had the experience of going from when an email message was a really exciting thing that deserved a lot of attention to where it was, where we suddenly had a glut of attention demand. So this to me indicates we will always have both the one-to-many model for people whose attention is demanded by many people and who can't be in an infinite many-to-many environment, and we have a need for discussions on this side, and I think that these things will balance.
Thank you very much. I want to ask, I want to thank all of you for your perseverance. I'd like to just close with one brief thought, and it has its roots in First Amendment values. As disparate as some of our attitudes may be about conventional, traditional media and the new media, it does seem to me that there is one common thread that should be binding us close together. And that has to do, in the most basic way, with the need for a society that's free not to have its speech regulated or controlled. Those words that begin with Congress shall make no law lead into a precious 45-word statement, the brightest line in the Bill of Rights. And anyone who thinks that discussion about regulation of the old media or the new is not a clear and present and continuing danger, I think is kidding himself, herself. And so I just would close with a plea that all of us understand that as much as we may admire figures in government or as much as we may demean them, ultimately their ability to regulate the speech of citizens is a threat that puts all of our liberties in jeopardy. And with that, I'll ask you to join me in thanking the distinguished members of the panel. And thank all of you for your presence.